thought he might need a translator. I told him, "You use English every day." But my dad had argued that he didn't know the language of cars. To him, everything had its own language. The language of breakfast, the language of business, the language of politics, and on and on. In Spanish, he knew all the languages, but for as long as he'd been speaking English, he believed he knew it only in certain realms. He never talked about cars with anyone in English, he said. Therefore, he didn't know the language. It was no use explaining to him that I didn't exactly spend my days talking about cars with people either. To him, I knew all the languages of English the way he did those of Spanish. And as proud as he was that I was so good at one, I think he was also ashamed that I wasn't better at the other. The cars were in a big cluster, parked at odd angles, some with their tires in a rut, some without tires at all. My dad walked through the maze of them, his hands in his pockets, and examined them silently. After a few minutes, a small gray-haired man in a plaid jacket came out to greet us. "Good morning," he said, shaking my dad's hand. "How can I help you folks today?" "We want to buy a car," my dad said. The man nodded. "We've got a few. Did you have something in particular in mind? A sedan or a wagon? A truck, maybe?" "I like something fast," my dad said. "A sports car?" the man asked. My mom tugged my dad's sleeve like some kind of warning that he'd better not get too carried away. Predictably, my dad ignored her. "Do you have anything Italian?" my dad asked, as if he hadn't just seen everything on the lot. "An Italian sports car?" the man's eyes widened. "Afraid not. What we've got here is mostly American or Japanese. There's a few Volkswagens in the bunch, but Volkswagen's about as European as you're going to get. I have one, about 15 years old, that still runs about as good as Secretariat when she was in her prime. Transmission's manual, so you could probably crank it up, get her going pretty speedy. You want to take a look?" I doubted my dad understood everything the man said, but he followed as the man led us to the back corner of the field, where a small car, brown like cocoa powder, sat in the sun. "Here she is," the man said. "Just got her last week from a fellow down in Bear. Not much wrong with her as far as I can tell. There's a dent in the hood, and the seatbelts are a little slack, but the lights work, gear shift is smooth as silk, and it's got power steering. Only 32,000 miles. Little bit of rust around the wheel wells, as you can see, but the radio works. AC still gets cold. Not that you need it this time of year," he chuckled. "She'll probably last you another 10 years. A real beauty, if you ask me." I wouldn't have gone that far. The car was small and unspectacular. But compared to the rest of the inventory, it might as well have been a Lamborghini. And I could tell by the way my dad was eyeing it that he was hooked. "How much?" he asked. "We run the Kelley Blue Book values on all these, so our prices are fair." "How much?" my dad asked again. $2,300, the man said. My mom made a noise. "You got that?" the man asked. My dad, suddenly a master negotiator, shrugged. "We were just looking," he said. "You aren't going to find much better than this," the man said, patting the car's hood. My dad peeked in the passenger side window. $2,200, the man offered. "Times are tough. I'll give you folks a break." My dad wandered around to the other side of the car and checked out the view through the driver's side window after smudging some frost away with the heel of his hand. My mom shivered against the wind. "Rafa," she said. The old man glanced at her, apparently interpreting this as my mom's way of telling my dad that it was time to go, because he said, "Okay, 2,000 even. That's the best I can do. And you could drive her off the lot today." My dad took one more lap around the car, the sunlight bouncing off its rear windshield. Then he asked, "Do you take a check?" We drove home, $2,000 poorer, in our new Volkswagen Rabbit. In that big field, the old man, whose name we learned after we agreed to buy the car, was Ralph Mason, gave my dad a quick lesson in the vagaries of manual transmission. My mom and I sat in the back seat as Mr. Mason, from the passenger side, took my dad through the gears, telling him when to depress the clutch and when to let it go. "Take her up," Mr. Mason would shout. "Give her gas." And my dad would obey the best he could. He was a mess at first, and each time the car twitched, my mom would exclaim, "Ay!" But he took to the basic coordination of it surprisingly easily. After 10 minutes, Mr. Mason declared my dad a natural. "Best student I've ever had," he said, clapping my dad on the shoulder, and my dad beamed. In the back seat, my mom rolled her eyes. My dad didn't stall once on the drive home. Of course, he never made it above 30 miles per hour either, even when we got on the stretch of Route 141 between I-95 and Kirkwood Highway. He crept onto 141 cautiously, like a beetle onto the tip of a branch, and kept a steady pace even though all the other cars in existence were flying past us at warp speed, honking as they swerved by. "What are you doing?" my mom asked, buckled into her seatbelt in the front. My dad, focused on the road ahead, said nothing. "Everyone's passing us." "Let them," he said, gripping the steering wheel with both hands now that we were in gear. "No, this is not good, Rafa. You have to keep up." "The speed limit is 50, I said, trying to be helpful. My mom peered at the speedometer. "You're only going 25. Again, my dad said nothing. He offered no explanation, no defense. He just focused on the road ahead and on steering the car. A semi-truck roared by, sounding a long honk as it did. From on high, the driver gave us the finger. "I can't look," my mom said, putting her hand over her eyes. "This is awful." "Give it gas," I said, affecting the voice of Mr. Mason. "Both of you," my dad said. "I know what I'm doing." "I hope we don't see anyone we know," my mom said. "We're on the highway, Celia, not at a party." "This is so embarrassing." "No one we know even has a car," my dad pointed out. "We're not going to have one for much longer either if you don't go faster." "I know what I'm doing." "It's dangerous, Rafa. Everyone has to go around us." I had been glancing out the back window every now and then, watching people switch lanes and flash their headlights at us. At that moment, I saw a car that had been coming up behind us in our lane swerve out to the side just before it reached us. The driver hadn't realized until too late how slow we were going, or else he had miscalculated how fast he would catch up to us. He skidded onto the shoulder as my dad, totally unaware, kept moving us forward. The driver righted the car, put on his turn signal, and shot back into the traffic at the first opening. He careened around us, and as he passed by, yelled out his open window, "Learn how to fucking drive!" My mom slumped in her seat. "Ay Dios," she said. "It's a good thing Enrique's not here," I said. "We would never hear the end of it," my mom agreed. "We're almost there," my dad said. "Where?" my mom asked. "The exit." And when we pulled off, 2.5 miles later, my dad expertly brought the gears down to first, to idle at a red light. My mom sat up. "You don't understand," my dad said. "They stop you."
"Who? What are you talking about?" my mom asked.
"That's why I was being cautious."
"Who stops you?"
"The police. If you're white, or maybe Oriental, they let you drive however you want. But if you're not, they stop you."
"Who told you that?"
"The guys at the diner. That's what they say. If you're black, or if you're brown, they automatically think you've done something wrong."
"Rafa, that's ridiculous. We've lived here for 15 years. We're citizens."
"The police don't know that by looking at us. They see a brown face through the windshield, and boom, sirens."
My mom shook her head.
"That's what that was about?"
"I didn't want to give them reason to stop me."
"You were driving like a blind man, Rafa. That will give them reason to stop you."
"Everybody else just has to obey the law. We have to obey it twice as well."
"But that doesn't mean you have to go twice as slow as everybody else."
The light turned green. and my dad brought the car out of first. We cruised under the overpass, a shadow draping over the car like a blanket.
Next time, just try to blend in with everyone else, and you'll be fine, my mom offered.
The way of the world, my dad said.
What?
My mom asked as we emerged back into the sunlight.
Just trying to blend in. That's the way of the world.
Well, that's the way of America, at least, my mom said.
Even though the general mood in our house had lifted, I was still grounded, which meant that I hadn't seen Maribel since Christmas. I had told her back then that it was going to be a while before I could come over again. She'd been getting better about remembering things. I didn't have to repeat myself as often anymore, and sometimes she even referenced things we'd talked about days before. But I wasn't sure if she remembered this thing. And I hope she didn't think I was just ignoring her, or that I'd lost interest. If anything, the grounding just gave me time to miss her, and I'd sit at home most afternoons depressed, staring out the window through the frost creeping in around the edges, hoping to catch a glimpse of her getting off her bus. And then I would walk away, because I knew if I saw her, it would be torture. And then I would go back, because not seeing her was torture. And then I would try to steer clear of the window for a while and make myself do something else, like take a shower or read or play a game on my phone. But it was no use. I just paced around in anguish, not knowing where to look, not knowing where to go, and feeling like I was about to lose my mind. At school, things were no better. I sat at my desk, drawing hats and mustaches on the people in my textbooks while I thought about Maribel. I wondered what she was doing, if she was as miserable as I was, what her hair looked like that day, what she was wearing. Anytime a teacher called on me, I had no idea where we were in the lesson. I'd just say, huh? And usually, after getting a disappointed look, or even more often, a surprised one, I'd slump down in my seat and feel like crap. I went to the nurse's office and complained that I had a stomach ache, or that I had a headache, or that I was pretty sure I had the swine flu, so I needed to go home. The nurse would take my temperature and send me back to class every time. Sometimes, when I got home from school, one of my mom's friends would be in our living room, sipping freshly brewed coffee out of the Café Duran mugs my mom liberated from the cabinet only for guests. Occasionally, I was greeted by the sight of Señora Rivera, whose company my mom coveted, and any time she was there, I would linger in the hallway outside the kitchen and eavesdrop, waiting for her to say something about Maribel. Once, my mom mentioned my name, and after a pause, Señora Rivera said, "He seems to like Maribel, no?
Mayor?
He's been good for her, I think. She's different when he's around, more like herself."
"Really?"
My mom sounded genuinely surprised.
"Did something happen, though?"
Señora Rivera asked.
"He hasn't come over in a while."
"Didn't I tell you? Rafa grounded him. Mayor got into a scuffle at school, and Rafa flew off the handle as usual. Él es tan rabioso."
"It was serious?"
Señora Rivera asked.
"What he did at school?"
"No, no, it was nothing. Trust me, Mayor is a good boy."
Señora Rivera didn't say anything to that, and I wondered whether she believed my mom, or whether knowing that I'd been grounded had somehow ruined her image of me. One day, I came home from school to find Quisqueya sitting next to my mom on our couch with her legs crossed. She used to be a regular fixture in our house, but lately, I hadn't seen her as much. Her furry snow boots were by the door, and her white fur hat was in the center of the coffee table like a cake.
"How was your day?" my mom asked,
after I walked in and dropped my backpack on the floor.
"Okay. Anything interesting?"
"Nope." My mom said to Quisqueya, "He's a man of few words these days."
"Like all men," Quisqueya said, "except for my sons, of course. They call every night from the university to talk to me."
Tell me again, what university are they in? My mom asked, feigning ignorance.
Your memory is so short, Celia. They're at Notre Dame.
Oh, right, Notre Dame. I don't know why that never seems to stick with me.
Quisqueya twisted herself to look at me. I notice you've been spending a lot of time with the Rivera girl, she said.
My mom tisked. Not lately. Mayori's grounded.
Quisqueya gasped. Grounded?
My mom shook her head, like she was sorry she'd mentioned it.
It was nothing, she said.
Well, before. He used to spend a lot of time with her before.
Quisqueya twisted herself to me again. It's a shame about her, isn't it? But when I see you with her, the two of you seem to be having actual conversations, like real people.
You don't know anything about her, I said, my cheeks burning, my voice flat as a wall.
Not as much as you, certainly, Quisqueya said.
They're just friends, my mom said. Quisqueya replied,
of course, that's how it starts.
Mayor, go to your room and start your homework, my mom ordered.
I don't have any homework.
It's a good idea to do your homework, Quisqueya said. Hard work is what got my boys where they are. She faced my mom again.
Did I tell you they're both majoring in computer science?
You should hear them talk about their assignments. All these technical terms. They love it. But I have to tell them, please, I'm just your little mom. She smiled. I don't understand any of it.
Maybe that's because there's something wrong with your brain, I said.
Mayor! My mom snapped.
What did he say? Quisqueya asked my mom.
I'm sorry, my mom said. I don't know what's gotten into him lately.
I said, maybe you don't understand any of it because there's something wrong with your brain.
Quisqueya blanched.
Ya, Mayor, to your room, my mom said,
leaping up from the couch and pointing. When I didn't move, she growled,
now!
It was all just bullshit. Quisqueya and Garrett and my dad and every other person on Earth could say what they wanted, but Maribel and I were meant for each other. I knew it. So the next day, instead of going straight home after school, when I got to our building, I walked to her apartment. My legs were shaking for fear that my mom, or worse, my dad, would catch me. So as soon as Señora Rivera cracked open the door, peering over the tarnished gold chain latch, I said, "Can I come in?"
"Are you supposed to be here?" she asked.
"Is Maribel around?"
"Aren't you grounded, Mayor?"
"I was grounded, yeah, but I'm not anymore." I could see the hesitation on her face. "My dad called it off," I added. And finally, she let me in. I found Maribel in the bedroom, standing by the window. She was wearing the red scarf I'd given her at Christmas, and it was everything I could do not to walk over and kiss her right on the spot.
"Hey,"
I said. She turned around and gave me a puzzled look. "I wanted to see you," I said. Maribel stared at me, blinking with her long eyelashes.
"You got a car," she said at last.
"You heard about that?"
"Yeah.
It's not, like, a nice car or anything. And it's not mine, you know. It's my dad's."
"Where is it?"
"Out in the parking lot. My dad hasn't driven it since we brought it home."
"So the car is sad."
"It's sad?"
"It's lonely."
"If you say so."
"Should we visit it?"
"The car?" Then I realized what she was trying to do. See, she was smart. She was way smarter than anyone gave her credit for. I smiled. "I mean, sure, if you want to." We told her mom we were going over to my apartment, and I promised, as I always did, that I wouldn't leave Maribel's side the whole 30-step journey from her unit to mine.
"Don't say anything," I told Maribel as we squeezed in the door to my apartment.
As quietly as I could, I lifted my dad's car keys from the windowsill clutching them in my fist so they didn't jingle. Then I slipped back out and motioned for Maribel to follow me. The two of us were outside again before my mom even knew the difference. I opened the car door and let Maribel climb in, then hurried around to the driver's side and got in beside her. The car was freezing inside, and it smelled coppery and wet, like snow. I saw that someone, my mom I assumed, had hung a rosary over the stem of the rearview mirror. Maribel skimmed her hand across the bumpy faded leather on the dash. "My dad always wanted a car," I said, "since he was a kid. But he had a donkey instead."
"A donkey?"
"He named it Carro." Maribel laughed. "Yeah, I know. A donkey named Car. How dumb."
"Your daddy's funny."
"Not really," I said. I slid my hands around the steering wheel. When my foot accidentally rubbed the brake, the sole of my sneaker squeaked against the ridges of the pedal.
"Do you know how to drive?"
Maribel asked. "Pretty much," I said. "I took driver's ed last marking period, so I have my permit, but I haven't done the exam for my actual license yet. My friend William did it, though, and he passed it, no problem, so it can't be that hard. The only thing I'm worried about is parallel parking, but I probably won't ever have to parallel park unless I go to Philly or D.C. or something. I don't know. The driver's ed teacher, Mr. Baker, always made us drive by his house so he could feed his dog. Every year on mischief night, his house gets egged, and he complains to the principal about it, but it's like, duh, if you didn't take kids to your house all the time, no one would know where you lived, and it wouldn't happen. He's kind of stupid."
"You talked for a long time."
"I did?"
"It was like hours."
"No way, not even close."
"I don't mind," she said.
"What? You don't mind me?" I wanted to see what she'd say, but she just blushed.
"I like this car," she said. "It's very cool."
She grazed her fingertips across the center console, her nails scraping the hard plastic. I watched the delicate round bone at her wrist twist back and forth and felt blood pounding in my ears. I took a quick look out the windows and in the rearview mirror to see if anyone was watching. Earlier, I thought I'd heard a door shut, but when I looked now, the coast was clear. I didn't know how much time I would have before either her mom or my mom came storming out looking for us. I was getting all heated up, even though it was cold as hell in that car. I unzipped my coat.
"Mayor?"
Maribel said.
"Yeah."
I held my breath.
"I feel like you're the only person who sees me."
"Maybe everyone else just needs glasses," I said, attempting a joke, but it fell flat. And I squeezed my hands around the steering wheel until my skin pulled so tight I thought it would flare off at my knuckles. I turned to her. Ever since the first time, kissing her again was all I'd wanted to do. "Be chill," I told myself. "It's nothing. It's just..." I closed my eyes and leaned across the console until my mouth found hers. I put one hand on her shoulder, on her rubbery coat, gripping the fabric in my fist. Her nose brushed my cheek, and the wool from her scarf tickled my chin. After a few seconds, I slid my tongue into her mouth, shocked by the feel of her seashell teeth, and then by the wetness of her tongue as it touched mine. I moved my hand to her neck, her skin hot and soft, and holding her like that, my heart raced. Forget it. My heart was doing laps and hurdles and high jumps, and I swear the fucking pole vault. My pants got tight. I could sense it, but I didn't care. We just kept kissing, my hand under her scarf, and then my pants were damp and warm. I pulled back. I threw my hands over my crotch and angled my body away from her.
"What's wrong?" she asked.
"Nothing," I said. And man, if that wasn't the truth.
Nelia Safong. I am Boricua, loud and proud, born and raised in Puerto Rico until I told my mommy in 1964, the year I turned 17, that I wanted to live in New York City and dance on Broadway. My mommy put up one hell of a fight. You are only 17, you don't have any money, estás más perdido que un juez bizco, all of that. But I had a dream that I was gonna be the next Rita Moreno. I was gonna be a star. I told my mommy, you can look for me in the movies. And I left. I didn't know a soul when I got to New York. I slept on the floor of Grand Central Terminal for the first 3 nights. Watching everyone's feet walk past, men in loafers, women in patent leather heels, click, click, click. Everyone was somewhere to go except for me. I had gotten to my destination, and now what? A dream isn't the same thing as a plan. I started feeling like I wanted to return home, but the way I left, all that youthful righteousness and conviction that I threw at my mommy como un tornado, I would have been embarrassed to go back so soon. My mommy would have said, you see, Nena, you're just a little girl after all. No, I had planted a stake, and now I had something to prove to my mommy and to myself, to everyone from my neighborhood. I had to prove that I could make it. I got lucky, though. In the train station, I met a girl, this chica de compañía named Josie, who had gotten kicked out of her parents' house for smoking dope. She had a friend, a guy in Queens, who was going over for the war, and she was going to stay in his apartment until he got back. I'll never forget, she said, I have to water his plants for him so they don't die. Later, when he didn't come home, when they couldn't even find enough pieces of his body to put together to send back, she cried so much and for so long that I knew. She was in love with him. She had been waiting for him, every day pouring cupfuls of water into the pots that held his plants, turning them in the sunlight, taking care of them, because she thought it was a way of taking care of him. I lived in that apartment for 1 year. I had gotten a job as a waitress, but Josie never charged me rent. Her friend's parents were paying for the apartment, she said. It was covered. Instead, I put all my money toward dance classes and acting classes that I took in the mornings at a little studio in Elmhurst. For food, I ate leftovers off diners' plates at the restaurant. I scraped whatever people didn't eat into cardboard takeout containers and saved it for later. Hash browns, toast crusts, noodles, cream corn, todo eso. The boss didn't really care. I went to auditions when I heard about them. I remember there was an open call for Man of La Mancha at a small theater in Greenwich Village. I tried out for the role of the housekeeper. When I got there, a man was lining up all the girls. I remember I asked him whether it was okay that I wasn't Spanish, because of course it was a Spanish play. He said, "What are you?" I told him, "Puerto Riqueña." And he said, "What's the difference?" I didn't get that role, or any role after that. Not a single one. For years, I tried. After the news of Josie's friend, I had left the apartment in Queens because it didn't feel right for me to stay there. Josie refused to leave. She took over the lease. She kept watering the plants. Maybe it was denial. But maybe it was her only way of holding on to someone she had loved. Maybe we should all be so passionate. Once I was on my own again, I found a place in the cellar under a corner grocery store. Really, a cellar. It had damp stone walls and one window no bigger than a squinted eye. I danced all day and took trains and buses all over the city to auditions, and at night, I carried around trays of food and flirted with the men for bigger tips. On my walk home sometimes, and as I stepped back down in that cellar apartment, my eyes heavy from exhaustion, I would think, is this what it is? This country, my life, is this all? But even when I thought that, I was always aware of some other part of me saying, there is more, and you will find it. Oh, I didn't find it, though. I worked like crazy. I practiced dancing until my feet bled and my knees felt like water balloons. I rubbed Vicks into my cracked heels and took so many hot baths, I lost count. I went to a voice coach and sang until my throat was raw. I killed myself, but it never happened for me. The world already had its Rita Moreno, I guess, and there was only room for one Boricua at a time. That's how it works. Americans can handle one person from anywhere. They had Desi Arnaz from Cuba, and Tintan from Mexico, and Rita Moreno from Puerto Rico. But as soon as there are too many of us, they throw up their hands. No, no, no. We were only just curious. We are not actually interested in you people. But I'm a fighter. You get me against the ropes and I will swing so hard, bam! So I thought, well, if I'm not gonna find it, then there's only one other option. I will create it. I researched and found out that taxes for new businesses were lowest in Delaware, so I saved money for a while. I stopped taking classes and signed up for extra shifts at the restaurant and said goodbye to New York. I came to Wilmington to try to start a theater company of my own. I got a job as a waitress again, only at nights, at a bar this time, and during the day I worked on getting the theater going. It was a different time then. The society was different. Free love, fellowship, turn on, tune in, drop out. There were communities of artists, people who didn't want to work for the big corporations, people who were willing to help a girl like me, and many times they worked for free. I met a guy who helped me build sets and put up some lights. I did all the painting myself. I got a whole truck full of wooden pews from a church that was being renovated. I lined them up for the people I dreamed would one day come to watch my shows. The Parish Theater, I called it, because of those pews. In 1971, we had our first production, a play called The Brown Bag Affair. It was very racy, provocative, a lot of nudity, but the story was powerful, and even though for the first few weeks only a few people showed up to see it, word started to spread. First, we had an audience of 10 people, but eventually it grew to 20, everyone sitting shoulder to shoulder in those long pews. Every few months, we did a new show, and 2 years after we opened our doors, we were getting regular crowds for everyone. The theater wasn't making much money, but we were bringing in enough to keep the plays on. That by itself was some kind of miracle. Now, 20 years later, I still run the Parish Theater. We do just one production a week. I act in them sometimes, but the real pleasure for me now is giving roles to other actors, watching them perform, especially the young ones. I was like them once. I can relate. And now I think, okay, this is what it is. My life, this country. It took me so long to get started, and I never became a big star. But now I feel proud when I go back to Puerto Rico to visit my old neighborhood in Caguas, because in a certain way, I did make it, after all. A few months ago, I met a man who came to the theater. He's younger than me, a gringo, an attorney, so young and handsome. ¡Cielos! We have almost nothing in common, but somehow we're a good fit with each other. He makes me laugh. How can I explain it? He has a spirit. I'm 53 years old with wrinkles on my hands. I've never been married in my life. And now this? You never know what life will bring. Dios sabe lo que hace. But that's what makes it so exciting, no? That's what keeps me going. the possibility.
Alma. One day near the end of January, Maribel and I were sitting at the table going over her schoolwork when, 3 hours before he usually got home, Arturo walked through the front door, slammed it behind him, and marched down the hall. Maribel looked at me, confused. "I'll be back," I told her. I found Arturo in the bathroom, stripping off his clothes, tiny crumbs of mushroom soil raining down to the floor. He turned on the water and, without waiting for it to warm, climbed into the shower, burying his head under the spray. "Are you okay?" I asked. He didn't answer. I rested my hands on the rim of the sink, feeling the cool, smooth porcelain, and stared at myself in the mirror. For a second, fear got the best of me. What was it? Something with the boy? Did something happen? I asked, trying to conceal the anxiety in my voice. Arturo pulled his head out from under the water, heavy droplets streaming down his face, dripping off the tips of his mustache. "You really want to know?" he said. "I was fired."
"Fired?"
"Yes, because I changed my shift. The morning when I stayed home for Maribel's first day of school."
"But that was months ago."
Arturo turned off the water, twisting the handle so hard I thought he would break it. I watched as he picked up his towel from the floor and rubbed himself dry. The hair matted on his barrel chest, his limp penis hanging between his stocky legs.
"I don't understand," I said. He snapped the towel against the floor.
"Chingao."
"It has to be a mistake.
They went through all the trouble of getting you a visa. Why would they do that and then turn around and fire you?"
"Because they're cowards."
"What does that mean?"
"The only reason they sponsored our visas was because the government was pressuring them to hire workers with papers. But now everyone's saying it was all talk."
"But why does that mean they have to fire you? What are they going to do? Get rid of everyone they already have and hire people without papers now?"
"Probably. It saves them money that way."
I thought, I could call his boss and explain the situation. Maybe if he knew about Maribel, he would have some sympathy. Maybe if he knew what it meant to us. This wasn't how it was supposed to happen. We had followed the rules. We had said to ourselves, we won't be like everyone else, those people who packed up and went north without waiting first for the proper authorization. We were no less desperate than them. We understood, just as they did, how badly a person could want a thing. Money or peace of mind, or a better education for their injured daughter, or just a chance. A chance at this thing called life. But we would be different, we said. We would do it the right way. So we had filled out the papers and waited for nearly a year before they let us come. We had waited even though it would have been so much easier not to wait.
And for what?
Arturo finished drying himself in silence.
"I worked hard," he said after a long time.
"I know. I did what I thought." "I know," I said. We were both quiet for a moment. "Maybe I could look for a job," I suggested.
"No. Our visas are only for me to work. I have 30 days. If I can find something within 30 days, then we'll stay in status. It can be anything, just a paycheck, and our visas will be good." I reached toward him, But he stepped back, tense, locked in his thoughts. "You'll find something," I said. So, during the day, every day, Arturo looked for work. He dressed in his church clothes, black pants and a button-down shirt, a brown belt, his cowboy boots, and walked into store after store, asking for applications. People laughed in his face. They told him, "Haven't you heard that the economy's in the shitter? We can't get rid of workers fast enough." They told him, "Crawl back across the river, amigo." And yet what else could he do but try the next place, and the one after that? We had to take money from our savings to pay the rent. There was no other choice. Arturo and I tried reasoning with Fito, but Fito was firm. "I feel bad for you," he said. "I do. But I have a mortgage to pay, and it depends on collecting the rent." Arturo shook Fito's hand and assured him we would bring him the money soon, even though both Arturo and I feared that might not be true. 2 months, we estimated, was as long as we could go without a paycheck coming in. I made rice and beans, and rice and beans, and more rice and beans. But since we couldn't afford chiles or ham or anything to spice it up, we soon grew tired of rice and beans. "Oatmeal," I suggested. "We still have oatmeal left." But neither Arturo nor Maribel wanted that either. We walked around the apartment in the shadows, turning on the lights only after the sun had gone down. We kept the heat off at night. We showered every other day to save on water. I still washed our clothes at the laundromat. But I carried them home, sopping wet, and laid them all over the kitchen counters and the floor to let them dry. I would have draped them over the balcony railing except that I was afraid they would freeze stiff. Instead of sitting at the kitchen table at night drinking tea, now I simply boiled water for Arturo and myself instead. But the water was a poor substitute, and trying to pretend otherwise only made me more depressed. I tried to be at the apartment during the day in case Arturo stopped back at home, either to eat or to drop off applications. I made him food and gave him pep talks, and then he was off again, ready to try somewhere new. I went only as far as the Dollar Tree or the laundromat, both of which were close enough that I didn't have to be gone for long. The community house was too out of the way, and even though I had gone back to the English class there only a few times, now I stopped going altogether. I still wanted to learn English, though, so I asked Celia if she would come over to teach me a few things. She brought a workbook that she and Rafael had used when they first came to the United States. It had illustrations to show basic vocabulary, words for colors, foods, parts of the body, animals, like a child's book of first words. "Rafa and I both learned English in school in Panama," Celia said. "But when we got here, we had to refresh our memory." We sat at the kitchen table while she said, "Miércoles, Wednesday." I repeated the words. "Jueves, Thursday," she said. I said, "Thursday." "Not Thursday," she said. "Thursday. Push your tongue out against the back of your teeth." "Where is my tongue now?" I asked. "At the top of your mouth, I think. Push it out." But I didn't know what she meant, and each time I repeated it, "Thursday," Celia corrected me. "Thursday. Thursday. 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 No. Thursday. Thursday," I said.
You got it, Celia cheered. When I didn't have a lesson with Celia, I made it a point to at least sit in front of the television with the dictionary Professora Shields had given me and look up as many words as I could while they flashed across the closed captioning on the screen. I learned the phrase, "Are you hiring?" and taught Arturo the words. I thought maybe if he approached potential employers in English, he would have a better chance. But after trying it at various places, he said, "I feel silly. I say it, and then they answer me in English, and there's nowhere to go from there. They look at me like I'm stupid." "You are not stupid," I told him. "To them I am," he said. And yet, despite the stress of the hunt and the anxiety over what it would yield, since that night in the kitchen, I felt closer to Arturo again, if only by inches. And I could tell that he felt closer to me, too. He took my hand sometimes under the blankets while we lay next to each other in bed. And once, while I stood in front of the sink washing the dinner dishes, watching bits of food float in the soapy water, he came up behind me and threaded his arms under mine, cupping my shoulders and resting his chin on the back of my neck, as if he simply wanted to be near me. Our wedding anniversary was on February 19. And though usually in Pátzcuaro we went out to dinner, we didn't have the money for that here. But Arturo wanted to honor the tradition, so we made a plan to go out for drinks instead. Waters, we decided, since even sodas were beyond our means by then. We went to the pizza restaurant down the street because Arturo had submitted an application there, and I knew he was hoping that if he showed his face again, maybe someone would recognize him and maybe somehow he would walk away with a job. We were down to 1 week, a mere 7 days before we would lapse out of status. The restaurant was in the corner of a strip center. A striped vinyl banner above the door heralding its presence and its name. Luigi's. Inside it was filled with square tables and metal-framed chairs, and the aroma in the air was sweet and sharp. Tomatoes and cheese. We had told Maribel on our way there that we were only ordering water. "Can we order horchata?" she asked as soon as we sat down. "They don't have horchata here," I said. "Is this a restaurant?" she asked. "Yes, but they don't have horchata." "Do they have pescado blanco?" she asked. "We're not ordering anything," I said. "Why not?" "We're here to celebrate." "With water," Arturo added. We ordered 3 waters without ice. And when they came, we sat together, sipping out of pebbled red plastic glasses, celebrating in silence, while around us American couples and families ate slices of pizza and drank bottles of beer. I had the feeling that they disapproved of us being there, drinking only water, taking up space. But when I glanced at the people around us, no one was even looking in our direction. And I felt the way I often felt in this country, simultaneously conspicuous and invisible, like an oddity whom everyone noticed but chose to ignore. And then, the front door opened, and I snapped my head up to see who it was. The boy, I thought. I don't know why. On the walk over, I had been convinced that he was following us. And I had peered over my shoulder, thinking I'd heard the clatter of his skateboard behind us. But all I saw was Arturo giving me a quizzical look. Now, though, it was only a young mother who walked in, pushing her child in a stroller. I held the glass to my lips and took a deep breath. A few minutes later, Arturo broke the silence that had settled over us like fog. "Well," he said. 19 years.
19 years, what? Maribel asked. 19 years that your mother and I have been married. She was 18 when I married her. Don't say that, I said. It makes me feel so old. You are old, Maribel said. Arturo laughed. What's funny? Maribel asked. Yes, what's so funny, Arturo? Do you have a joke? Maribel asked. Your father doesn't know any jokes, I said. Oh, I know jokes. Like what? Here's one I heard on one of the American late-night shows. Why did the bicycle fall down? He scanned our blank faces, waiting for a response. When he got none, he said, because it had two tires. That doesn't make sense, I said. Well, the audience laughed. Maybe the subtitles were wrong. It was tired, I said. That's why it fell down. You think you can do better? Arturo asked. Let's see you tell a joke. A joke about what? Anything. Yes, Maribel said. I looked around the restaurant for inspiration. We are waiting, Arturo said. Hold on. Maybe you can order one from the menu, Arturo offered. Waitress, water's for us. And one joke for my wife. Skip the straw. Maribel smiled. I'm getting funnier by the minute, Alma. You better think of something quick if you want to keep up with me. I stared at the table and tried to concentrate. Finally, to satisfy them, I told the only joke I knew. One that had made me laugh out loud when I heard it, even though I never repeated it myself. I said, why didn't Jesus use shampoo? I don't know why, Arturo asked. Because of the holes in his hands. Arturo looked at me in shock. At the sight of his face, I crossed myself. God in heaven, forgive me. Then Arturo started laughing. Even Maribel, who months earlier never would have been able to process a joke like that, put her hand over her mouth to hold in her laughter. Arturo raised his glass and toasted. To the funniest woman I know, he said. Thank you, I said. Arturo frowned. Nothing about me? Sorry. To the best man I know. That's more like it. And the best daughter, I added. The best, Arturo said. I looked at them both. The way Arturo's mustache turned up when he smiled. The way Maribel's face glowed. The best, I repeated. 7 more days passed. 7 days of knocking on doors and making calls and begging with store owners and anyone who would listen. But at the end of it, Arturo came up empty-handed. I found him in the morning, the day after the deadline, sitting in the thin blue light. His head bowed, his fingers entwined behind his neck. I went to him and put my hand on his shoulder with all the tenderness I possessed. I wanted to heal him somehow with my touch, to save him from feeling that he had let us down. He said, I'm sorry. You did everything you could have done, I said. If anyone finds out, who's going to find out? She would have to leave her school, Alma. No one's going to find out. He ruffled his hands up through his hair. We haven't done anything wrong, Arturo. He didn't respond. We're not like the rest of them, I went on. The ones they talk about. He unclasped his hands and looked at me, his expression sad and weary. We are now, he said. At the tail end of February, there was an ice storm. That's what Celia called it. I phoned her not long after it began. When the rapping against our windows got so bad, I thought for certain those hundreds of tiny collisions would break the glass. I was home alone. Arturo was still searching for a job, not for our visas now, but because we needed money. And when I heard the light taps followed by great thwacks like horse hooves against the panes, the thought crossed my mind that it was kids in the neighborhood, tossing rocks against the window. But when I looked, I saw a glinting silvery spectacle against a white sky. Splinters of rain. When Celia answered the phone, she said, "It's an ice storm. They'll be sending the children home from school soon, I'm sure. Don't go outside unless you want to fall and break something." The last time this happened, Jose's walker slipped. He broke his wrist and had to wear a cast for 6 weeks. "It's ice?" I asked. "Coming from the sky?" "I know," Celia said. "Can you imagine?" "Is it chips of ice?" "More like spears, I think." "Well, that sounds dangerous. More like toothpicks." "Toothpicks of ice," I repeated. All winter, we had been anticipating snow. Everyone kept saying how strange it was that we hadn't had any yet. But I'd never heard anything about falling ice. Celia said, "When it's over, it's actually very beautiful. In White Clay Creek Park, there's a marsh that freezes, and the children go skating on it. Maybe Maribel would like it. Should we go? It's something to see at least." "Maribel doesn't know how to skate on ice." "She doesn't need to. Everyone just slides around in their shoes. Let's go on Sunday after church. The roads will be clear by then, but the marsh should still be frozen." "Is it far?" "A few miles. There used to be a bus, but it doesn't run that route anymore. Maybe we could drive." "It would be fun. You could use a little fun, couldn't you? Rafa hasn't even driven that car since we got it, and then Maribel can say she went ice skating." The wonders of this country. In Mexico, men sold ice out of carts they attached to bicycles. Here it was falling from the sky. Imagine, I thought, if Lake Pascuara froze all the way through. I wanted to tell my parents that we had walked in our shoes on islands of ice. They wouldn't believe it. They would think we had gone to the moon. "Yes," I told Celia, "let's go." That Sunday, we all stood in the parking lot next to Rafael's car, waiting for him to tell us where to sit. He scratched his head and stared at the car. "You didn't realize this was going to be a problem?" he asked Celia. "You could have brought it up too, you know." "I thought you had a plan," Rafael said. "I did," Celia said. "That you would drive us. That was my plan." Rafael said, "Okay, just let me think." "A once-in-a-lifetime event," Celia said, and Arturo turned to me and chuckled. Most of the ice on the ground had melted, although the tree branches were still lined with it, bowing under the weight. In the sunlight, telephone wires looked like glass strings high overhead. Bushes glistened like cakes made of diamonds. Starbursts of frost etched themselves against our windows. At night, the trees clapped together in the wind and made a delicate tinkling sound. We couldn't believe our eyes, nor our ears, nor the fresh sting in our noses. "What world is this?" I had asked Arturo. And he just shook his head. Rafael said, "Okay, let's try this." He opened the back door. "Alma, you get in first. Then, Celia, you get in next to Alma." "Who's sitting in the front?" Celia asked. "I'll sit in the front," Mayor volunteered. "Arturo can ride in the front with me," Rafael said to Celia. "He's bigger than you." Celia looked Arturo up and down, then motioned for him to come over to where she was. "Stand there," she said. She turned so the two of them were back to back. She was a finger width taller than him. I think it's you, Arturo, Rafael said. But Celia wagged her finger. No, I'm taller than him. Rafael massaged his temples as if the whole thing was giving him a headache. Bueno, you sit in the front. Arturo, please get in next to your wife. Mayor, you go on the other side. What about Maribel, Mayor asked. She can sit on her father's lap. Arturo and I were the only ones in the car so far. Come here, Mari, Arturo said, patting his thighs. Let's see if you can fit. Maribel stuck one of her legs into the car and backed her rear end in through the door, ducking her head to clear the opening. But when she lowered herself onto Arturo's lap, even with one of her legs still outside of the car, she was too high to uncurl her back and neck. Por favor! She can't sit like that, Celia said from outside. Come back out, Rafael said, extending his hand. She can sit on my lap, Mayor offered.